This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. We'll visit with Jerry Sepos. He's headed the Manship School of Mass Communication for the last 7 years. He's retiring as the dean. Martin Johnson will be the new man in charge, but Jerry Sepos remains as a professor, and he has a long career in journalism, including running the Knight Ridder newspaper chain. A recent Pew survey shows 52% of Americans think that the news media does a bad job reporting fairly on politics. We'll talk with Jerry Sepos about what's going on with fake news and the attacks on the media and whether this is a new thing or have we been down this road before. Also, writer Ken Jennings, his book is Planet Funny, How Comedy Took Over Our Culture. Ken Jennings explains how we built our humor-saturated modern age where lots of us get our news from comedy shows. Now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thanks for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Ali Baltazar and Becca Dill are producing today, and in studio for most of the hour is Jerry Sepos. Come June 30th, he'll step down after 7 years as dean of the Manship School of Mass Communication. He's being succeeded by Martin Johnson, who'll be with us, I'm told, in early July, but Jerry Sepos came to this post in 2011. He was University of Nevada, Reno dean for 3.5 years prior to that, and his career was spent largely in the world of print journalism, vice president of news for Knight Ridder, which at the time was the second largest newspaper company with 32 newspapers, dailies. And in 2016, Jerry Sepos was named by the Society of Professional Journalists as a fellow in recognition of extraordinary contributions to the news professions. Profession, and almost at the same time, the organization named him one of three winners of the first ever Ethics in Journalism Award. Good afternoon, or good morning, Dean Sepos.
Good morning, Jim. Thank you for being a loyal graduate of our school.
Well, it's an honor to have attended the Louisiana State University, the Journalism School, which was not the Manship School at the time I was there, and there are a lot more bells and whistles now. And some great graduates. And in the last 7 years, some of your people have been at the forefront of some of the biggest news stories in the country.
Yeah, including certainly what's happening in Washington today. So we're very pleased. We're actually having a reception in Washington next week where we're going to talk about some of those alums.
Yeah, LSU, and in particular the Manship School, has a large contingent of graduates living and working in Washington, D.C., so I would imagine you'll be there with hundreds of your closest friends.
I'm not sure about hundreds, but a lot of people, and it's fascinating to look at the range of careers that people end up in after graduating from the Manship School, from lobbying to journalism to you name it.
Well, you were reared in Washington, D.C., weren't you?
I was born in Washington and grew up in Silver Spring, Maryland, and went to the University of Maryland, and I'm trying to convince my Miami-born wife to move back there someday, but she discovered this winter that winters there are not like they are in Miami.
But I'm told the University of Maryland rivals LSU as far as the scenic beauty. It's a beautiful campus, isn't it?
A beautiful campus, and actually a friend of mine who's the dean at Maryland will be at our reception on Thursday.
Well, 877-217-5757. You'd like to talk to Dean Sepos about what's going on in journalism in America. And if you're dialing locally, 297-5633, and you can email us, talk@talklouisiana.org. Jerry Sepos will be in Washington, D.C., the Beltway, and, of course, that's where much of the news is produced in America. Washington and New York are the two principal locations. And the President of the United States has gotten mileage out of making accusations that elitists are in control, and it's time to drain the swamp. Do journalists in those locations, do they kind of have a smug attitude about the rest of the country, or is that overplayed?
Well, I think that's over with now as a result of the last presidential election, but there's certainly no question that journalists on the coasts, as well as other people on the coasts, overlooked a lot of the rest of America when they were predicting what was going to happen in the election.
Well, in New York City, Donald Trump's hometown, he got 15% of the votes in his hometown. In Washington, D.C., I don't think he even got 5%. It was just a total blowout in those two cities. And journalists they're susceptible to public opinion. And when everybody's saying this guy's going down for the count, That has to have some impact. But is it possible to put all that aside and to view the big picture, or did, for the most part, journalists miss the boat in 2016?
Well, I think for a large part, they missed the boat in 2016. But because of that, I think there's a change now. And I know that Dean Baquet, the editor of the New York Times, who's a fan of Tiger football, has said that he wants more people planted outside of New York City, more reporters in the rest of the country, so they're not influenced the way you're talking about.
Dean Baquet is an example of a guy who did not graduate from a university. Brian Williams, no college degree. Chuck Todd, no college degree. Rush Limbaugh, no college degree. Sean Hannity, no college degree. Why is a journalism education important?
Well, it's those are exceptional people in many cases, and I think Dean Baquet did not need journalism education or anything else because he's so creative and brilliant and has such good judgment. But most of us need a journalism education because what we teach above all is how to communicate. And on every survey you see about employers, the most important criterion in hiring is, can you communicate? Can you tell your boss what's going on? Can you tell your coworkers what's going on? And I think the very best journalism schools teach, and mass comm schools teach students how to do that.
I mentioned going in that a recent Pew survey shows 52% of the Americans polled think the news media do a bad job reporting fairly on politics. That's more than half the country. That figure, some would probably say, well, what's new? Well, it's up. It's up a lot, 25% 30 years ago. So it's more than double. About a quarter of the country thought the media were in large part unbalanced and unfair, and now more than half. Of course, we've had a few episodes of partisan journalism, if there is any such thing, and maybe that's contributing to this.
Well, partisan journalism started back during the American Revolution, or even before then. Most newspapers were allied with one political party or another. So it's been around for a long time. Well, something I'm looking forward to in the fall, I'm going to be teaching a graduate seminar on what qualifies as fair journalism in the current frenzied environment. I have not told the students who have signed up for it that I do not know the answer, but I'm hoping that they'll come up with one.
Well, when I watch MSNBC and Fox News, and I do occasionally watch Fox News, sometimes I wonder if I'm living in the same country.
Right. And I'm actually a fan of CNN, which largely is down the middle, I would argue. Some people disagree. But in some of the small talk, the unscripted small talk that happens between segments, there is incredibly partisan dialogue seeping out. One of my favorite examples, I was watching it, I confess, in The Office because I tuned into a lot of news. And a Republican senator said something that wasn't brilliant, and the anchor rolled her eyeballs. There was no need to do that. You could decide for yourself whether the senator knew what he was talking about or not. But it was such a blatant example of unfairness seeping into the news that it really bothered me.
And this is on television.
Correct.
A visual medium.
Yes.
And who was a Republican senator? Was one of our guys, was it?
It was not.
John Kennedy certainly found a way to get on television a whole lot, and quite likely will be soon be announcing his candidacy for governor, and we'll talk about what's going on in the state as well. But with people having the option now, there used to be this something called the fairness doctrine where you couldn't slant one way or the other. You had to have some sort of semblance of balance or you wouldn't be allowed to stay on the air. But now, if you're a liberal, you can choose to watch MSNBC all day long and get your opinions largely reinforced. If you're a conservative, you can choose to watch Fox News or listen to Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity all day long and think that you're well-informed. But is it possible to do that when you're just taking in basically news that reinforces your own personal belief system?
No, that doesn't educate anybody very much. And what I wish is that people took advantage of this panoply of sources out there, because no longer is the editor sitting up there and saying, here is what you need to know. It's really a wonderful time for journalism. You can get a vast variety of views, not just on TV, but on the Internet, obviously. And what I wish consumers of news would do is to take advantage of that and to dip into different sets of opinions. I'm afraid that doesn't happen, and what does happen is what you described.
I think National Public Radio does a remarkable job of balanced reporting and gets unfair claims that it's from a liberal slant. Now, I think a lot of liberals listen to NPR, but there are surveys showing that a lot of conservatives do as well. But the news on Morning Edition, which is the most listened to radio program in the country, is fair and balanced. And if President Trump were savvy about numbers, you got over 20 million people listening to Morning Edition, and he gets all lathered up about a show, Morning Joe, that has 400,000 viewers nationwide. And the impact of Morning Edition is far more substantial than Morning Joe.
Yeah, it is, and I find it very hard to explain, and I wish the president would do what I was suggesting other consumers of news do, and that is to dip into many different sources of news rather than just the few that he appears to be following.
And he does consume the news. And some say that these entities like MSNBC, Fox, CNN, they're laughing all the way to the bank. They've done rather well, haven't they?
Well, and some print organizations have done well, too. The New York Times and the Washington Post both say that they've done well. I'm not sure we've seen any audited numbers, but I'm very much willing to believe that.
Well, I was in Colorado for a few days ago, and I went walking one day, and I noticed going down one block in Vail, Colorado, there was a New York Times in every driveway in Vail, Colorado. So what does that say? That the New York Times is doing pretty well right now.
Correct.
But our local newspapers, I'm not as well. And we'll talk with Jerry Seppes about what's happened to papers like the New Orleans Times-Picayune, once one of the great newspapers in the world, now down to three printed days a week. What's happening in the world of journalism? 877-217-5757, back after this pause. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. Allie Baltazar and Becca Dill are producing, and your number is 877-217-5757. We'll go to the phone lines in just a bit with Jerry Seppes. Also, you can send us an email if you so desire, talk@talklouisiana.org. Jerry Seppes is stepping down at the end of the month as dean of the Manship School after 7 years, and he will remain, at least for the near term, as a professor of note at Louisiana State University. And we were discussing the status of local journalism and how it is being affected in the age of Trump. And Jerry's got voluminous notes here, and I see one headline, and I'm reading upside down here. Let's see. Now he's turned it around for me. This is a headline, and I since Jerry has it, I assume this is not fake news, but it's a startling headline. He says, Google and Facebook now make more from ads than every newspaper, magazine, and radio network in the world combined. That's a big change. Huge change.
That is a huge change, and I don't know if there's a little bit of inaccuracy in there, but I doubt it. I think it's probably correct. Some other figures show that between the year 2000 and 2016, I don't have more current figures, that print products have lost half of their advertising revenue, and the number is probably even greater now.
877-217-5757. Dan downtown. Dan, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana with Dean Seppes.
Yes. Can corporate America's advertising dollars sometimes bury or slant stories to its advantage and to the disadvantage of the average consumer?
Corporate America? Certainly, most news organizations, and that's, of course, one of the beauties of public broadcasting, but most news organizations are corporate entities. And Jerry Seppes, I've been around long enough to know of some reporters who have been called out if they did a story about a client that was not favorable. That's part of human nature. It's the old axiom, you don't do something where you eat. And it's sometimes it's a difficult call, isn't it?
It is, but I think the answer to Dan is that most mainstream news organizations have very good protections to prevent that from happening. The downside of this multiplicity of new news organizations, which is really a good thing overall, but the guy who can start a news site at home in his pajamas, as they say on the internet, The downside is that I don't think people like that necessarily have strict codes of ethics. So if you're talking about a mainstream organization, I do not worry about that. If you're talking about an upstart organization, I do worry about it. And actually, referencing what Jim said, I remember when I was the editor in Silicon Valley, we fired, it's a very Silicon Valley story, but we fired a reporter who covered business and was let in on an initial public offering, a stock deal, by a friend. And she thought there was no problem, and we thought if you're covering business in Silicon Valley, there is a problem there, and she was fired.
Well, Dan, thank you for your question. And today there's a front-page story in The Advocate, Louisiana legislators promote bills helping their families and clients. Certainly lawmakers are not immune to corporate influences either.
Yeah, that's an astonishing series that The Advocate is doing, and quite remarkable because it's interesting. If a mainstream journalist did what legislators do, he or she, as I said, would get fired, but it seems to be okay in the legislature.
Yeah, and there have been instances where people have been reprimanded for contributing, like journalists. Journalists, I've seen this, but in some organizations and for good reason, you don't drive around with a bumper sticker on your car promoting a candidate, even if it's your spouse's car. You don't have a yard sign in your front yard. Every now and then, by the way, I live on a heavily traveled thoroughfare, and somebody sticks a yard sign in my yard, and I tell you, I am out there, Johnny on the spot, getting rid of that because I don't want to be perceived as having a horse in the race. But sometimes there's this blur writing checks for candidates. Remember Keith Olbermann when he did that? There's some things that you just shouldn't do as a journalist.
Exactly right, and I was very, very careful as a journalist never to do that kind of thing. And in fact, we had ethics rules prohibiting yard signs, as a matter of fact. Occasionally somebody would say, you're limiting my First Amendment rights, and our position was that you're our employee and we can do that. I don't know that that was ever tested legally, but
well, they have the First Amendment right to do it, but there's also a repercussion for doing that if you're a journalist.
Correct.
Yeah, you really, most times you have to decide whether you're a journalist or an activist, and it's hard to be both. But now we have this blurring of activists who are journalists, and we see this on these cable channels.
And that's why, again, I think the informed news consumer, I don't have a problem with him or her digging into those kinds of channels at all, but the informed consumer ought to be aware of what he or she is watching.
All right, a listener, this is Tracy at the Capitol, asking if there is bias in the media, often accused of being a liberal bastion, and maybe journalists are, on the whole, a bit more liberal than the rest of the country, but I think sometimes that may be overplayed. Your thoughts?
I again would say that mainstream organizations try to be very careful to avoid bias. Bias is in the eye of the beholder, so it's hard to say that. But again, you have this blurring that you just mentioned, Jim, of news organizations and of individuals who are mixing up activism and journalism. And, you know, many internet sites would say, what do you mean? I'm biased. That's my job. And people at MSNBC or Fox might say that too. So again, the way to avoid being influenced by biased journalism is to know what you're looking at and what the source is for the news. And is this a good mainstream traditional news organization?
There are some journalists, and I think Jim Lehrer, the longtime host on public broadcasting, is one of them, who did not vote, thought it was inappropriate for a journalist even to cast a vote.
Right. Len Downey of The Washington Post, who's been on at our school a few times, was editor of The Post after Ben Bradley, and he wrote a famous piece saying that he did not vote. I think that's going too far. But I would tell you I've occasionally registered as an independent because I didn't want people knowing which party I favored. I'm not sure anybody ever looked me up, but it made me feel better.
Well, and that information is accessible.
Right.
But journalists have opinions, and quite often the national media, the gatekeepers, are accused of being liberal. But to give an example of how sometimes this can be blurred, I would think that most of the people working for the Washington Post and the New York Times and for the major networks are making good money, and they probably benefited from the Trump tax cuts because the people who earn good money are the ones who benefited the most. And yet, on the whole, the newspapers of record in this country did not support that tax cut. So in some cases, journalists are going against their own personal self-interest.
Well, and their corporate officers probably are too, by saying we prefer objectivity to saying we like the tax cut. So that's what good news organizations do.
Well, yesterday, the Advocate of Baton Rouge, New Orleans, and parts unknown, front page editorial, A Ship of Fools Sailing Nowhere, harsh words about what's going on in our state capital. Is this somewhat unprecedented?
I don't know enough history since I've only been here 7 years, but I don't recall seeing a front page editorial in The Advocate in my time. And nationally, it is very, very unusual. But clearly management felt strongly about the situation and had actually a strong and beautifully written piece. And I'd love to know, I'll have to ask them if any readers objected or praised them or just ignored it. But I thought it was very well done.
Well, it starts this way. Partisan divisions have not seeped but flooded into Louisiana's governing processes in a way that few would have predicted only a couple of years ago, as yet another collapse of a special legislative session in Baton Rouge this week made clear. Since the election of Governor Edwards in 2015, the ordinary wrangles over taxes and budgets have been elevated into political warfare, with the GOP leadership of the House in last-ditch opposition to the governor and to their own Republican colleagues in the Senate, who brokered a compromise with Edwards, talking about 17 cents on a $100 purchase. That's what this debate is over, writes the Advocate. And the editorial concludes, "Our ship of fools is rudderless. It's time for the people, through their collective outrage, to save it from the shoals of crisis." 877-217-5757 is your number for Talk Louisiana. We're back after this pause for the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757. Allie Baltazar and Becca Dill are producing, and another segment with Dean Jerry Seppas, stepping down into the month after 7 years as the head of the Manship School of Mass Communication at LSU, one of the real treasures in journalism in the state and beyond, recognized nationally for its work in many areas over the last 20 years at least. And as I said, back in the day when I was there in 1981, when I was at the Daily Reveille, we had three people on that staff who won Pulitzer Prizes, and Alex Martin, James O'Byrne, and Russell Carolla. And we didn't have a lot of bells and whistles, Dean Seppas, in those days. But for whatever reason, going back well before my tenure, Rex Reed and Smiley Anders and Edwin P. Newman, a lot of famous journalists spent some quality time at LSU.
Yeah, the school has a great history, and that really makes managing and leading it much easier, because there are so many alums you can lean on for advice. As I said, we'll see a lot of them in Washington in a week. But the heritage is wonderful, and that really helps. And the heritage is not just in journalism, although it used to be known as the J School, but the heritage is in political communication, in digital advertising, and in public relations. So it's really a well-rounded school at this point.
And you're even getting into a sports curriculum.
We are. We want to do more with sports. If any school should do more with sports communication, it's LSU.
Can the Daily Reveille survive?
Well, when you say survive, I don't know if you mean in print or otherwise. In print, it is a rough haul because of some of the same influences that have affected, what do you call it, professional journalism. But the Daily Reveille very much can survive online, and our audience relies on the Internet for almost everything. So it certainly can survive online, and it is now in print one day a week. And there's some discussion that maybe it should be in print more than that.
877-217-5757. Walter in Raceland. Walter, you're on the air with Dean Seppas of LSU. Good. Hi, Walter.
Hey, good morning. A couple of comments. First of all, Edwards, like his predecessor by the same name, is a typical tax and spend socialist Democrat, okay? And most people in Louisiana are much more conservative. They send their more conservative representatives to the state capitol, and so this partisan wrangling that gets us nowhere is only to be expected. Second of all, the reason that the major newspapers are losing readership is twofold, and they're both based on the Internet. It's much more convenient and less expensive to just sit down in the evening when you're eating your supper or whatever and get the news from your favorite news outlets on the Internet, like Information Clearinghouse, for example, is an excellent one.
All right. And, well, Walter, you're on a roll, but where do you get your news?
Places like that, Information Clearinghouse. Now, I
do you, you listen to public radio? Obviously, you're listening right now.
This is the first time I've listened to public radio, and I couldn't tell you how many years, and the only reason I am is the fact that I'm sitting here waiting for somebody to show up, and I didn't have anything else to do. I used to support NPR, but I just got so fed up with the socialist programming. You know, you mentioned that Fox News and Rush Limbaugh as conservatives. They're not conservatives. They're fascist people. The true conservatives are someone like Ron Paul.
All right. You've given Dean Sepas much to talk about. You know, I had a journalist here when I became the manager of WRKF 15 years ago saying, so I see you're going to National Socialist Radio. And, of course, it was a joke, but it was a very bad joke. And this is a capitalistic country. And for people who say that the America that we know is a socialist country, I think if you live here, it's not a socialist country. And the media are reflective of the country as a whole.
Yeah, that is the key point. The media are reflective. And you'll find editorial pages in different parts of the country championing different causes for that very same reason. I'll disagree with the listener. I actually find NPR, one of the straight-ahead news organizations. I know a lot of you will disagree with that. But it has less of what I was talking about earlier, the small talk where personal opinions can slip in. It's very well scripted, tightly tightly run, and I happen to disagree. But again, the wonderful thing about the Internet and the life we're in right now is this panoply of places where you can go for your information.
I recall many years ago when I was a reporter, this would have been 1991, Operation Rescue, the anti-abortion group, came here and had a big protest at the old Delta Women's Clinic on Bennington Avenue, and I was doing stories for NPR, and the first time I did a story, I referred to the two sides as pro-life and pro-choice, and they say, no, it says it's anti-abortion and abortion rights. And I think that was fair, and that was a better way of describing the two sides. So I do think that National Public Radio tries to go the extra mile, but is often accused of being liberal, because if you listen to NPR and then you listen to Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity, then obviously NPR is going to be to the left of them, as just about anybody would be. But those two people, Limbaugh in particular and Hannity to a lesser extent, have spawned legions of imitators all across the country who don't do it nearly as well as they do. So we live in a country where talk radio is almost exclusively conservative. Up until now, Fox News over the last decade has been the bellwether for cable news and is still, on the whole, the highest-rated cable news program in the country, cable news channel. How is the age of Trump going to change this, if anything? Or, like, for example, I see Shepard Smith on Fox News, who occasionally criticizes President Trump. That would not have happened probably a decade ago.
Well, and a military analyst from Fox News who quit has really come out and said some stunning things about the organization. So I think what you're going to find is more self-reflection because of Trump's charges against the media. And while the charges often bother me, there's nothing wrong with more self-reflection. And actually, the example you gave a minute ago of language about pro-life and pro-choice and all that is very telling, because there was a time when phrases like that would just pop out of your mouth and it would go unchallenged. Now, every style book I know of in the country deals with language about abortion and many other things. Mm-hmm. So I think the reflectiveness of the media has grown a lot and is going to grow a lot more under the Trump regime.
Well, during the buildup to the Iraq War in 2003, the so-called socialist media was largely on board with President Bush and reporting weapons of mass destruction, which did not exist in Iraq. But one of the news entities that did not do that was your group. You were the guy in charge, Knight Ridder. Why did you not fall prey to the propaganda, if you will, that other news outlets did?
Well, first, let me make clear that it was the folks who worked with me who were responsible, and I was just applauding them from afar in the corporate headquarters. But our Washington Bureau said, you know, what is being written about weapons of mass destruction is just not true. And several reporters had had sources often on the record saying there is no sign of weapons of mass destruction in the Gulf region. But the experience was one of my more remarkable ones because even though we had 32 daily newspapers that had access to this remarkable coverage, many of our editors said, you know, I don't think they're right. And the reason was, well, the New York Times says there are weapons of mass destruction. That reporting was later discredited. And the Times actually credited Knight Ridder for getting it right. Sometimes editors and reporters get swept up in sort of the majority opinion, and this was one of those cases.
And there's a film related to this as well.
There is a movie called Shock and Awe, and my wife and I are going to a screening of it Monday night in Washington, and it should be widely available very soon.
All right. Neil in Oak Hills, talking about the state of media as we know it today, is commenting about some of the things that we discussed. And you did not fall prey to the propaganda, if you will, leading up to the Gulf War. Was this a concerted effort by the administration, the Bush administration at that time, to put out false information, or did they just have it wrong? Was it an honest mistake?
Well, I wasn't in Washington at the time, so I can't say for sure. But I think the Bush administration, at the very least, was uncritical of this information and said, gee, there must be weapons of mass destruction. And, you know, the Bush administration can do whatever it wanted to do. What bothers me tremendously is that so much of the media uncritically accepted that information. The job of the journalist is to verify information, not to uncritically accept it.
Here's a question from Kylie about Twitter. How has Twitter affected news reporting, and in particular the tweets from the president?
Twitter has had probably the most dramatic effect of anything. First, it tips us off to many news stories. I will hereby confess that I get a lot of my tips about what to read by looking at Twitter, and then I call on the link. I tweeted three or four times yesterday, once about Donna Britt retiring, and then about some other things. It has had a remarkable influence. And the president's tweets, I have to say, are news, and a lot of people say they're not. When the president is sitting there giving off-the-top-of-the-head opinions, I happen to think that's news, and he's figured out how to use Twitter for better or for worse.
He's learned how to dominate the news cycle.
That's correct.
It used to be that presidents, even the president, would respond to what was going on in the world. Now it is Donald Trump's world, and whatever he decides is news is what we end up talking about, it seems.
I was reading a piece last night, excuse me, that said that interest in local news has declined because Trump news has filled the space just everywhere, and I think that's really true.
But there's always a local angle. Take Stormy Daniels. Perhaps the most famous person in America, outside of President Trump, is Stormy Daniels, pride of Scotlandville Magnet High School. Thank you, Dean Seppas. Always a pleasure.
Good luck, Jim.
In your hometown of Washington, D.C., speaking to the alumni next week, and thanks for your service the last 7 years.
Thank you,
sir. Fine job from Dean Seppas.
Thank
We're
you.
Back after this pause. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana, and thanks to Dean Seppas for joining us. We switch gears, and we're now joined by journalist Ken Jennings. He's the author of the critically acclaimed New York Times bestsellers Because I Said So, Maphead, and Brainiac, and is a 74-time champion on the quiz show Jeopardy. Well, let's start there before we get to his fine book, Planet Funny. He talks about humor, and Jeopardy has a little bit of humor, but 74-time champion. You must know your stuff, Ken Jennings.
I guess a few things.
Yeah, is Alex Trebek, is he a nice guy, or is he a little bit of a jerk?
I think some viewers don't like Alex because I think he comes off as snooty, but I think that's just, you know, he has to tell people the right answers. That's his job. In person, he's actually, he could not be more different. When the cameras go off, he's very loose and funny. He just keeps it moving when the cameras are on because that's what the show demands.
Well, your book is Planet Funny, How Comedy Took Over Our Culture. And Ken explains how a lot of us get our news from comedy shows. And we were just talking with Dean Seppos of LSU about how many of us watch cable news, and depending on which channel we're watching, we're getting news slanted one way or the other. But some people just, they just blow that off and watch comedy on cable and feel like they're just as well informed, and maybe they are.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole generation that I think as many people say they get their news from The Daily Show as from USA Today now. So the people who are writing the satire are now primary news sources. You're hearing the story for the first time as you hear the comedian make jokes about them, which must change the experience.
Well, this is an exceptional book and includes many people that we know well from pop culture. And let's start with Muhammad Ali. Before he became the fast-talking, fast-punching great athlete that we know and perhaps the most famous media personality of all time, he was influenced mightily as a young man when he was still Cassius Clay by the wrestler Gorgeous George. What happened when Muhammad Ali, Cassius Clay, was exposed to Gorgeous George?
Yeah, I love this story because I don't think people know that, you know, as a young man, Muhammad Ali was actually kind of soft-spoken and modest and, you know, tried to come off as very earnest in interviews. And then one time in Vegas, he was on the same radio show with Gorgeous George, and he saw how a professional wrestler does an interview, you know, just all the boasting and the catchphrases, and I'm gonna murder him. He's never going to come back from this, you know? And Ali suddenly saw a different future ahead of him. And I think that's the moment when sports became funny, you know, when promoters and owners realized that it was an asset to have an athlete who, win or lose, would say something funny in the locker room after the game or today on social media after the game. And now essentially all of sports is like this. You've got, you know, hundreds of athletes looking for that broadcast job after their career, and it's just one of many fields that didn't used to be funny, and now humor is almost enforced.
You have a chapter titled Softening the Blowhard. You say Donald Trump's charisma is different. The clowning and on-air, on-camera ease are great levelers that, against all odds, convince millions of people that a Manhattan landlord billionaire was one of them, a champion of the working family. And you say the xenophobia and racism were part of Trump's appeal to big swaths of his base, but the president's over-the-top comic persona seems to have helped him there as well. Donald Trump's not the guy I see when I think of the funniest person in America, but there certainly is a comical aspect to aspects of his life and his behavior.
Yeah, I don't find him particularly funny, but that kind of over-the-top WrestleMania thing he does is, you know, not that different from Gorgeous George. And I remember during the campaign, you'd read about people going to his rallies and they would just be starstruck and they would act like they had gone to see a favorite comedian. They would say things like, he tells it like it is, or he's not afraid to go there. And I really do think that's part of what gets kind of this off-the-wall third-party type candidate elected for the first time in American history is, first of all, his supporters thought he was funny, and it kind of allowed people to think of him ironically, like, oh, he's saying kind of terrible-sounding things, but that's just Trump being Trump, you know. People didn't take him perhaps seriously enough early enough.
He has managed to have entertainment as a part of his persona. When we watch Donald Trump, there is a magnetic quality to him. If you like him or you don't like him, people usually listen to what he has to say.
That's a pretty new phenomenon in American politics, too. You know, it used to be that there was this ironclad law that politicians should not be funny. And, you know, today that's just gone out the window. You know, Al Franken can go from Saturday Night Live to the Senate. And I think really the watershed moment there is Bill Clinton in 1992, you know, going on Larry King and Donahue and playing the saxophone with Arsenio. And at the time, there was all kinds of outcry about how this wasn't dignified. But as soon as he won that election, that rewrote the playbook.
The book is Planet Funny, How Comedy Took Over Our Culture, from Ken Jennings. And you say that if David Letterman was your gateway drug to ironic remove, Spy Magazine was the hard stuff. We're going back now to the 80s and 90s. Spy Magazine was not a substantial success, but it was successful enough that it lasted a long time. How did it affect you and others who were exposed to the, quote, journalism in Spy Magazine?
I remember discovering it accidentally as a teenager, and just, you know, when you're that age, of course, you love that kind of snarky, cynical voice because it seems like an impression of adulthood. And I loved it. I started writing a Spy Magazine lookalike column for my school paper, which did not go over well. I got called into the principal's office almost immediately. Nobody wanted a hard-hitting gossip column in the student paper, you know, making fun of the fall play and the bake sale. But the thing about Spy Magazine is, even though it only lasted a few years, that voice it created of just kind of disdain toward everything is now kind of the default tone of the Internet. You know, our whole culture now speaks Spy Magazine all the time, basically.
Where are we going? We've evolved from Spy Magazine to the environment we're in today, which includes President Trump as the leader of the free world. Can we get any more outlandish than we already are?
It's funny, you know, everybody, people have said that Trump is the death of satire. How are you going to do political jokes when he's doing it all seriously? And yet satire continues to proliferate incredibly. You know, Seth Meyers and Stephen Colbert now host late night shows that are essentially The Daily Show, except they're on network TV. So our appetite for this stuff seems to be bottomless. And I think it's a little oppressive now. Jokes don't come as a relief anymore when there's just so many of them all the time. Hundreds of them scrolling by your phone at any moment as you look at your social media feeds. But I think it's changing our brains to expect this, and this is now the new normal in our society we can't get away from.
I like a line that you have here. Funny is like a virus. Once it adapts to a new vector or colonizes a new host or spreads to a new population, it's almost impossible to eradicate.
I believe it. You know, once somebody in a field looks funny, once Muhammad Ali is funny, for example, any other athlete in that field who's not doing jokes looks stodgy and old-fashioned. Nobody's going to cheer for George Foreman when Muhammad Ali is doing his little poems with Howard Cosell. And I think that's true in any medium. Once Bill Clinton decides to be funny, or Donald Trump decides to be funny, everybody else has to change their stump speech. And so it's very hard to go back once the glass has been broken.
You note, Ken, that Woody Allen, when he was just starting in 1965, he actually had jokes that were about sexual escapades. And of course, Bill Cosby, the same. With what has happened in the last few years, there are certain things that now are beyond the pale. You just can't do the same kind of act you once did, right?
I think that's true, but I'm not overly concerned about it. You know, I don't feel like many comedians have complained about this. You know, Jerry Seinfeld says that he won't play colleges anymore because the kids are too sensitive. And it's a certain type of older comedian that you hear that from. It doesn't really concern me that much. I have not noticed a real chilling effect on speech the way comedians keep warning us if they can't do their kind of cheap, edgy material. Really, I haven't noticed that there's any kind of shortage of quippy people in our culture speaking their mind today. I mean, quite the opposite.
Right.
There's more of that than ever in our hot take culture.
We're short on time, but a listener asked about Michelle Wolf, who was the comedian at the correspondence dinner, and she irritated some people, but what did they think they were getting?
Yeah, I mean, for decades, that has always been that kind of an event. You know, Stephen Colbert said, you know, just kind of awful deadpan things about President Bush, and everybody laughed. It's just, I think, a sign of our increasingly divided and polarized political environment that people will weaponize any joke, whether they understood it or not, whether they were actually offended by it or not. It just becomes a weapon.
Well, the book is funny, and it's titled appropriately, Planet Funny, from Ken Jennings, 74-time Jeopardy winner, How Comedy Took Over Our Culture. What's the toughest question you got in Jeopardy?
The toughest question I got on Jeopardy. The hardest part is actually just that little interview segment where Alex wants to know a fun fact about you. Try to do that 74 times. I did not have 74 fun facts about myself.
Well, now one of the fun facts is that Ken Jennings has wrote Planet Funny, and it's out and about, and we thank you for sharing your story. Thank you, Ken.
Hey, thanks for coming.
We're back tomorrow, same time, same place. Until then, for Allie and Becca, I'm Jim. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.